cornucopia of agriculture. But maybe it was low on water. The woman's gaze was downcast, which, as everyone understood, meant that she was focusing on the screen of a tablet below the camera. Once she understood that the link was up and running, she raised her chin and seemed to stare directly into the hammerhead with a pair of huge, dark eyes. The low quality of the video made these seem pitch black, with no distinction between iris and pupil, and starvation had given them a sort of hot gleam. "Aida," the woman said, by way of self-introduction, "I see you, Dr. Harris." She began to smile, offering a glimpse of bad teeth, then thought better of it. Her eyes changed direction momentarily to someone or something off camera, then came back to them. She raised her tablet up closer to the camera so that she could look at the feed from Endurance. Her hand passed briefly in front of the lens, and they caught a glimpse of dirty, ragged fingernails, the frayed and shiny cuff of a sleeve. Faint murmurs in the background suggested that other people were in the same arclet with her, off-camera. She was in zero-G, therefore not part of a bolo. Her eyes were exploring the feed on her tablet, trying to make sense of what she was seeing. The hammerhead had not existed at the time of the break, so it was a new thing to her.
"Steve Lake,"
she muttered as she recognized him.
"Bo,"
Bo said.
"Michael,"
Michael said.
"Who's in the charge?"
Aida asked.
"Is Ivy?"
"Ivy's still alive, and she is still the commander as per CAC,"
Tube said.
"She's off shift. We can wake her up if you need to speak to her urgently."
"No, not necessary,"
Aida said, recoiling slightly and narrowing her eyes just a bit. The distance between her and Endurance introduced a time lag in the video, which made conversation halting and awkward.
"How many do you have?"
Dube asked.
11.
Dube, accustomed to working professionally with extremely large numbers, couldn't quite process one so small. 11. 1 plus 10. A thought came to him.
"Do you mean 11 arclets?"
That would imply scores, maybe 100 people. Aida looked amused.
"Oh, no. Of arclets, we have many more. We have 26.
"Ah. So what is it you have 11 of?"
"People,"
Aida said.
"Aida," Bo said, "just to be clear, so there is no misunderstanding, you are speaking for the entire swarm, and you are saying that, of the entire swarm, there are 11 survivors."
"Yes, plus one."
"One what?"
A look of amusement came over Aida's face. She broke eye contact. It almost seemed that she rolled her eyes a little. Dube was reminded, hardly for the first time, that the Arkies had been sent up as teenagers.
"It is complicated. Let's just say there is one more who might as well be dead."
Those in the hammerhead still could not quite process it. Something occurred to Michael.
"We know that the swarm broke up into two factions, one led by JBF. You were part of the opposing group?"
"Yes."
Aida laughed. Again, she reminded Dube of a teenager going through the pretense of talking to a clueless parent about something they would never understand. Michael, a little wrong-footed, went on haltingly.
"And so, when you say that there are 11, plus one who is, I take it, in a bad way, anyhow, are you referring just to the anti-JBF faction?"
"They were defeated a long time ago, months."
"When you say that, do you mean that there was some kind of a conflict? A war?"
Dube asked.
Aida shrugged. "There was some fighting."
She didn't see it as important.
"Call it a war if you wish, more like some brawls. The real battle was, you know, on the internet. Social media.
Silence ensued. Aida waited for them to respond. When no one did, she shrugged.
What were we going to do? Smash our arklets into each other? There is no way to have, like, actual violence in this setting. So we just had a war of words.
She held her hands up in front of her, making them into little pantomime mouths, aimed at each other, thumb jaws flapping up and down,
trying to, you know, persuade others to join our side. Trying to make the other side look bad, just like the internet always was.
She chuckled, put one hand to her cheek, rubbing her eye.
Look, it is very complicated, and I cannot explain everything right now, how it all came out.
But you said that JBF's faction was defeated,
Michael said. Of all the people in the Hammerhead, he seemed most committed to the proposition that there was a reasonable and logical explanation for all of this.
Her and Tav, yes.
By which you mean you defeated them with words, ideas, a social media campaign.
We were more persuasive, Aida said. I was more persuasive. Arklet by arklet, they came over to my side. The white arklet held out for a while, then they gave up.
What became of them?
JBF is fine. Tav, not so good.
He's the one you mentioned. The 12th one who might as well be dead.
I am afraid so, yes.
So, getting back to the earlier question,
Dube said,
the number you quoted is for the entire swarm. Both factions.
Aida, finally seeming to understand what they were getting at, sat up straighter and got a more serious look on her face.
Yes. There are no other survivors whatsoever. Of the 800, 11 remain.
There was a long silence as the four in the Hammerhead took this in. They had all harbored fears that the swarm might go terribly wrong. But this was worse than anything they had imagined. Finally, Dube raised his hands in front of him, palms up, and shrugged.
What happened?
Agriculture crashed.
Aida turned her head and stared off camera for a few moments.
I mean, I could say many things, but that is basically it. Between the CMEs, algae blights, lack of water, very few arklets produce food anymore.
What have you been eating?
Aida snapped her head around, as if surprised by the question, and looked quizzically into the camera.
Each other. Dead people, I mean.
There was a long silence during which Dube, Beau, Michael, and Steve all exchanged looks. The terrible thing was that they had considered doing the same thing many times. Every freeze-dried corpse that they jettisoned was a big collection of protein and nutrients that, from a certain point of view, could seem mouth-watering. Seeming to read their minds, Aida went on,
"And you?"
"You mean, have we resorted to eating dead people?" "No,"
Dube said.
"Tav started it," Aida said. "He ate his own leg. Soft cannibalism, he called it. Legs are of no use in space. He blogged it. Then it went viral."
No one had anything to say to that. After a few moments had gone by, Aida continued,
"But Endurance is better stocked with MREs and so on. Plenty of water. You would not have gone there."
"No, we did not go there,"
Dube said. He could tell from the body language of the others in the Hammerhead that they were too shocked to be entrusted with speaking at the moment.
"As for us," Aida said, "you should also know that supplies were conserved. Even as people died and we lost the Arklets, we moved what we had into the Arklets that survived. Our 26 Arklets are well stocked.
With everything except food?
Dube said. Yes.
Do you have enough water to match our trajectory?
Yes, Aida said. She was a beautiful young woman, Dube thought, with a fierceness about her that helped explain her success in the social media campaign against Tav and JBF. We have performed all of the calculations. If we jettison Mass and pack all we have into a heptad, we can make the rendezvous around the time of your next apogee. But we will need to know your exact params.
We will discuss your proposal,
Dube said,
and make any necessary preparations.
He looked over at Steve Lake, who severed the connection just as Aida was about to say something. They sat in the banana and discussed it as if there was anything really to discuss. They all registered their rote shock and disgust at what the swarm had been reduced to. It all sounded hollow to Louisa. Finally, she spoke up. It was what Louisa did. They expected it of her. They relied on it. 7 billion died. Next to that, this is small. And God knows we've all thought about eating the dead, so let's not pretend to be shocked that they actually did it. The real reason we're all freaked out by this is that our hopes have been dashed. We thought that the swarm was going to contain hundreds of healthy people, lots of food, lots of good company. Oh, intellectually, we knew it wouldn't be the case, but we were all hoping for it. Now we learn it's 11 carrion eaters. Are we going to leave them to die? No. We're going to make room for them and for their heptad full of scarce vitamins.
I am terrified of the woman Aida,
Michael Park said. Louisa sighed. Let me throw out an idea, which is that you're terrified because you wonder, at some level, whether you could turn into Aida if you got hungry enough.
Still, to let her on board Endurance.
And JBF too,
Tekla said. She and Moira were sitting next to each other as they always did, hands clasped, fingers intertwined.
I hoped I would never see Julia again,
Camilla put in.
I know it is small and selfish of me, but...
I understand all of your misgivings,
Ivy said,
because I share them.
The question, now, is whether those misgivings are going to have any effect on the decision we make. Are we really going to let one-third of the surviving human race die because Aida's creepy and we hate JBF? Obviously not. So we transmit our params and our burn plan. And during the remainder of this orbit, we make arrangements to accommodate some new Arklets. The remainder of the orbit was busy indeed, to the point where they broke out hoarded rations and upped their calorie intake to fuel their brains and their bodies. In the middle of that 10-day stretch, however, was an intermission. Dinah and Ivy had wordlessly agreed to spend it together in what Dube had once called the woo-woo pod, and what they now called the couple. After the break, when Reese had re-engineered Izzy and Ymir into a single moving sculpture of metal and water, he had moved this module to a different location in the stack, and then let the living ice flow around it, completely surrounding its inboard hemisphere, and later building up in a protective brow that shielded part of its windowed half. It projected from the side of Endurance like an eyeball, and gave people a place to go when they wanted to look at the universe. As such, it had no legitimate function from an engineering point of view. In fact, it was a liability, since it got hit by little rocks from time to time, depressurized, and had to be repaired. Anyone in it was getting directly exposed to cosmic radiation, and so it was a no-go zone when they were passing through the Van Allen belts, which was often. But people loved it anyway, and kept patching it up when it was broken, and went there when they wanted to be alone, or when they wanted to share some special time with another person. Putting it there had been one of Reese's best moves as a designer, and Dinah silently thanked him whenever she used it. Dube's old term for it had begun to seem a little tasteless after the hard rain. For a little while, people had instead referred to it as the dome. But dom had a different meaning in Russian, and so they'd settled on cupola, or kupol, whose meanings in English and Russian, respectively, were not too far apart. In the latter language, it carried a vaguely religious connotation, having to do with cathedral domes. Ivy and Dinah didn't have to worry too much about cosmic rays during the intermission, because they had so arranged it that Kupol was on Endurance's nadir side, facing toward Earth. And Earth was close enough to fill their view. Useless as the planet might be for the support of life, it still acted as a very effective cosmic ray absorber. Nothing was getting through that, short of another mysterious agent that could pass all the way through a planet and keep on going. So, Dinah and Ivy hovered in the middle of the sphere, arms linked so that they wouldn't drift apart, and sucked bourbon from plastic bags, and looked at their old planet for the last time. In their 6 years of hurtling around this world, they'd grown accustomed to the steep angle that Izzy's orbital plane made with the equator, and the views it afforded them of the high latitudes. Because of the changes they had lately been making to Endurance's plane, however, they were now confined to a belt around the tropics. Not that it mattered a hell of a lot with Earth in its current state. The sky was still on fire, streaked with the bluish-white incandescence of the hard rain. The ground, where they could see it through smoke and steam, was a mottled terrain of dully glowing lava. Some of it, the hot impact craters of recent big meteorites. Some of it spewing up out of the Earth's fractured crust. Oceans were dark at night, hazed with steam and daylight, their coasts difficult to make out, but clearly shallower than they had been. Florida was reaching out toward the Keys, but being battered down and chipped away by bolides, and washed away by tsunamis, even as it did so. A year and a half ago, a big rock had torn the lid off the long-dormant Yellowstone supervolcano. That had been cloaking most of North America with ash ever since then. Glimmers of yellow light in the northern extreme of their view hinted at a vast outpouring of magma. A long-suppressed habit told Dinah absurdly that she should go and turn on her radio in case Rufus was transmitting. This made the tears come, and that, in turn, made Ivy's tears come. And so they spent the last half of the intermission, from perigee onward, gazing at Earth through water. It didn't really affect the view much. But Dinah tried to register the memories as best she could. Humans would not again look on Earth from such a close vantage point for thousands of years. The burning planet started to drop away from them. It would only ever get smaller from now. They needed to get back to work. But they found it difficult to let go of each other. Back in the old days, before Zero, they'd had the occasional heart-to-heart about their shared, secret fear that they weren't qualified to carry out the mission for which they'd been sent up at vast taxpayer expense. That they'd screw it up, fall on their faces, and embarrass a lot of people on the ground. By now, of course, they had long since put those fears to rest, or at least seen them overwhelmed and buried by much greater fears. Ever since the beginning of the Cloud Ark project, however, and especially since they had made the irrevocable decision to build Endurance and go on the big ride, it had frequently come back to them in a bigger and more dreaded form. What if they were completely getting it wrong? They could scarcely remember now the great civilization that had once spread across the planet below them. But the contrast between it and its orbiting residue was painful. The dirty, beat-up kludge that was Endurance was an embarrassment to the human race. Could they really have done no better than this? And now, after a voyage of 3 years, 3 years that had been an unrelieved spiral of decline, punctuated by catastrophes, they were reduced to a maneuver coming up in 5 days' time that seemed more and more desperate the more they thought about it. If they screwed it up, It would be their fault more than anyone else's. Of course, no one would be left to blame them for it. They went through these crises of confidence frequently, but usually at different times, so that one could pull the other out of despair. Right now, they were both feeling it together, and so they had to pull themselves out. Dinah was thinking about Rufus's last transmission. Bye, honey. Do us proud.
Okay, she said. Come on, sweetie. Let's get to work.
Work gave them something to do during the final orbit of the big ride, besides worry about what was going to happen at the end of it. The huge burn that they would make at Apogee, combining a final plane change with an acceleration into the fast lane, where Cleft rolled around the world like a ball bearing in a tire, and contained so many unfathomable chances that it beggared prediction. The new wrinkle, however, was this. Since they would be moving into a stream of rocks moving faster than they were, the rocks would be coming at them from behind, where Amalthea had no power to protect them. Early in the mission, Dube had dreamed of reconfiguring Endurance at the last minute, moving the vulnerable stuff around to the asteroid's other side. With the manpower they'd had in those days, it might have been possible. As it was, reduced to a crew of 28 starvelings, it was out of the question. It took all the people they had to make accommodations for the swarm's heptad. They would dock it in the middle of the stack, lock it in place with a few cables, and hope it stayed attached during the subsequent maneuvers. They would keep the hatch closed. The 11 members of Aida's group would simply stay in their arklets until it was all over. The justification was that they'd be safer there. The true reason was that no one wanted cannibals in the shared spaces of Endurance. The big project for Dinah, and for the small remnant crew of robot jockeys who tended to work with her, was getting ready to dump Amalthea itself. On one level, the idea seemed nearly unthinkable. They had, however, been planning to do it for a long time. Endurance's final series of maneuvers would have to be accomplished quickly, deftly, in an environment where the rocks tended to be much larger than the ones that made up the hard rain. In a sense, the boulders up there were the mothers of the tiny fragments that had destroyed the surface of Earth. Every time two of them collided, a few chips exploded outward from the impact, and a fraction of those ended up falling into Earth's atmosphere. The hard rain would continue until all of them had been reduced to sand and organized themselves into a neat system of rings. In any case, Amalthea's ability to protect Endurance from the impacts of baseball or even basketball-sized rocks was of little interest in a place where a rock the size of Ireland would be considered unremarkable. The entire ship, Amalthea and all, would be a bug on the windshield of such a thing. Their only way to stay alive, once they had entered the slipstream of the main debris cloud, was to maneuver around the big rocks and hope that they didn't get hit by too many little ones during their dash to Cleft. And that sort of maneuvering was impossible as long as Amalthea, which weighed 100 times as much as the rest of Endurance, was attached to her. In addition to Amalthea, Endurance was still burdened by a considerable mass of ice, which they had hoarded both as shielding and as propellant. It weighed a significant fraction of what Amalthea weighed, but unlike Amalthea, they could burn it. The basic plan was to split most of that ice into hydrogen and oxygen, then burn it during the final speed-up at Apogee. Over the course of a few hectic minutes, Endurance would expend most of her water weight by using it as propellant. Between that and the ditching of Amalthea, her total weight would drop by a factor of more than 100 in the course of an hour. After that, she truly would be like a bug, flitting around heavy traffic, dodging big rocks and taking hits from little ones until she made her way to Cleft. In any case, they had anticipated all of this long ago. Dinah and the other surviving members of the mining colony had had 3 years in which to reshape Amalthea from the inside. Seen from the forward end, the asteroid looked the same as ever. Internally, however, most of it had systematically been whittled loose. In a sense, the process had begun around day 14, when Dinah had set one of her grabs to work carving out a niche in which she could stash her electronic parts. Since then, it had proceeded in fits and starts. They'd moved a lot of metal in order to make a storage bay for Moira Crew's genetic equipment, which in a sense was the raison d'etre of everything else they had done in the last 3 years. Once that was safe, they had begun tidying up, enlarging the pockets of protected space, breaking down walls, and joining them together into a cylindrical capsule scooped out of Amalthea's back, called the Hammerhead, for the way it lay athwart the top of the stack. Thanks to a lot of ticklish work by robots in the last couple of years, the Hammerhead was now separated from the rest of Amalthea, 99% of the asteroid's bulk and mass, by walls of nickel iron that were only about as thick as the palm of a person's hand. This still made them extremely massive by the standards of space architecture, more than strong enough to hold in atmospheric pressure and to stop small bolides. But the additional tens of meters thickness of metal beyond those walls was now physically detached from the hand-thick walls and could be pushed away by a puff of compressed air. Or rather, given the disparity in masses, endurance could be pushed away from it. Most of Amalthea would stay where it was, and the radically lightened endurance would back away from it like a grasshopper springing off a bowling ball. When the time came, they would have to shatter the remaining structural links with demolition charges. One of Dinah's duties on the last lap, as they soared back up out of Earth's gravity well toward their rendezvous with Cleft, was to go out in a spacesuit and inspect those charges, make sure they were packed in where they needed to be and wired up correctly. She was the only person remaining who knew much about explosives, and so she was the only person who could be sure. Just another of those duties that would have left her half-paralyzed 6 years ago and now seemed routine.
"I know that we don't need any more bad news,"
Dube announced to the 25% of the human race seated around the conference table in the banana.
"But here's some for y'all."
No one said anything. Nothing could make much of an impression on them at this point. 48 hours remained before apogee, the final burn, the ditching of Amalthea, the dash to Cleft. If Aida's transmission of half an hour ago was to be believed, the remnants of the swarm would rendezvous with them shortly before all of those things happened. "Let's have it," Ivy said.
"I've been keeping an eye on a certain sunspot,"
Dube said.
"Kind of angry-looking. Well, about 20 minutes ago, it kicked out a huge flare. Not the biggest we've ever seen, but pretty big."
"So we're expecting a CME?" Ivy asked.
"Yeah. Somewhere between 1 and 3 days from now. I'll provide better estimates as soon as I have more data."
They all considered it. Until recently, coronal mass ejections had been of little concern to them, except insofar as they made them wonder how the people of the swarm were getting along. As for the tiny faction that had split away on Red Hope, it was assumed that they had long since been wiped out by one or more of the hazards and calamities that had inflicted such a death toll on the swarm. For the crew of Endurance, Amalthea and ice had provided plenty of shielding. Even the comparatively thin walls of the Hammerhead would protect anyone inside of it against the kind of radiation that would envelop them in a CME. But Endurance's flanks were now exposed. Grabs had been at work carrying away the last of the ice and feeding it to the splitters to be made into rocket fuel. They were storing the cryogenic gases anywhere they could now, pumping them into empty arclet holes and disused modules. Parts of the stack were seeing the light of day for the first time since the break.
"It'll affect our operations," Ivy concluded, "but this is a drill we know pretty well. Take amifostine, get your spacewalks finished before it hits. We should make arrangements to accommodate all non-essential personnel in the Hammerhead. Some of us will have to be down farther in the stack, but we'll have storm shelters ready."
"What about them?"
Michael Park asked.
"They are a problem," Ivy admitted. "They're in plastic arclets. They're gonna get cooked. Even if they have any amifostine left, even if they have enough water to fill their storm shelters, they're going to take damage. Ethically, we need to bring those 11 aboard Endurance and get them to safer places."
"The original plan was to send 3 people out on an EVA to lock down their heptad, make it fast to the stack, so that we could maneuver,"
said Zeke Peterson. Of all the crew of Endurance, he looked the most similar to his pre-break appearance. He was skinnier, of course, with a bit of gray around his temples, but his health was still good, and he'd managed to keep his electric shaver working, so he was beardless. After the deaths of Fyodor, from an accident, and Ulrika, from a stroke, Ivy had designated him Endurance's second-in-command. He referred to the fact that Endurance was about to shed 99% of her mass, which meant that the same complement of engines producing the same thrust could make her accelerate 100 times faster. The G-forces still would not be extreme, well within the range that humans could tolerate. But the maneuver would impose stresses on the ship's frame, the likes of which it had never experienced before. This was another of those eventualities that they had foreseen long ago and built into Endurance before covering her with ice. So most of Endurance came pre-rigged for higher acceleration. Provided that nothing had broken during the last 3 years, she'd hold together, albeit with a lot of loose junk sliding around her interior spaces the first time they hit the throttle. They hadn't planned, though, for the last-minute addition of the heptad from the swarm. This was awkward. It would be connected to the stack by a docking port, which wasn't designed to take a lot of mechanical strain. It was heavy, because Aida and her crew had crammed it full of supplies and strapped even more to the outside of it. For the same reason, Ivy didn't want to just ditch it. They could use those supplies. So the plan had been for 3 spacewalkers to greet the heptad and lash it into place with cables as soon as it arrived.
"We'll just have to see what we can do with robots," Ivy said, looking toward Dinah and Beau. "Just about everything we have out there is grimmed, correct? So it can operate even in heavy radiation?"
"We'll get ready for that," Dinah agreed.
"As soon as the heptad docks, the robots get to work," Ivy said, "locking it down as best we can. We open the hatch and get the 11 down the hamster tubes as fast as possible. They'll have no protection whatsoever while they're moving through those tubes. We'll have storm shelters waiting for them. They can climb into those and ride out the rest of the journey. The flight crew will operate out of the Hammerhead."
The next 2 days reminded Dinah of the new CARED expedition, in that there was a lot to do, but no way to affect the schedule. They were at the mercy of astronomical events. Part of her wanted to pull all-nighters until this thing was finished, but she knew she had to be well-rested and fed when it counted, and so she forced herself to eat and sleep on the usual schedule. When awake, she worked on preparations for the arrival of the heptad, pre-positioning grabs near the docking port that it would use, connecting cables to suitable anchor points, tuning up the programs that the robots would execute when it came time to snap the other ends of those cables onto the heptad, rehearsing them to check for places where the cables might snag. The timeline gradually came into clearer focus. Aida sent out a sharp request for amethystine and water to fill their storm shelters. Of course, it was impossible for Endurance to comply. They had plenty of both, but they had long since cannibalized all of their MIV parts, and so they had no way to transport them. Aida decided to roll the dice by committing all the water she had left to a large burn that would bring them to the rendezvous with Endurance a little earlier than they'd originally planned. Meanwhile, Dube's space weather forecast was becoming more precise. He had a better idea now of when the radiation storm would break over them, and thought that the timing was looking favorable. The Heptad might arrive before things got bad. It might be okay, after all, to have some spacewalkers out there to cooperate with Dinah's robots. Dinah didn't know how to feel about that. The schedule had been accelerated, and now she had to take into account the vagaries of human spacewalkers. If Aida's Heptad docked soon enough, Dube pointed out, they might be able to transfer many of her heavy supplies through the docking port into the stack and thereby reduce the awkward strains that all of Dinah's cables were meant to take up. Meanwhile, Ivy and Zeke, the pilots, were addressing similar last-minute convolutions in their mission plan. As they got nearer, they got better information about the part of the debris cloud that they'd be maneuvering through. They could clearly make out Clef's radar signature, as well as those of many other big rocks that traveled in its vicinity. A clutter of faint noise and clouds on the optical telescope gave them data about the density of objects too small and numerous to resolve. All of it fed into the plan. Dube looked tired and nodded off frequently and hadn't eaten a square meal since the last perigee. But he pulled himself together when he was needed and fed any new information into a statistical model, prepared long in advance, that would enable them to maximize their chances by ditching Amalthea and doing the big final burn at just the right times. But, as he kept warning Ivy and Zeke, the time was coming soon when they would become so embroiled in the particulars of which rock was coming from which direction that it wouldn't be a statistical exercise anymore. It would be a video game, and its objective would be to build up speed while merging into a stream of large and small rocks that would be overtaking them with the speed of artillery shells. The details, the sudden distractions and improvisations, piled up and thickened in a way that made Dinah think of a sonic boom on old Earth. The onrushing stream of air thickening and solidifying in the path of the airplane, turning into a barrier that must be broken through or succumbed to. They seemed to break through it at the point when Michael and two other spacewalkers pulled on their cooling garments, much patched and mended, and donned their spacesuits. Dube had the incoming Heptad on radar, then on optical, and verified that it was on course to rendezvous with them. This meant, of course, that the Heptad was on a collision course with Endurance. The difference between a collision and a rendezvous was the final burn of the Heptad's thrusters that would slow it down at the last minute and bring its params into nearly perfect synchronization with the larger ships. Endurance herself, still burdened with Amalthea and many tons of stored propellant, had next to no maneuverability. And so it would all be up to Aida, or whoever was at the controls of her Heptad. The reunion of Endurance and the Swarm began, as it turned out, with a collision. It was not a catastrophic high-speed collision, but it certainly was no orderly and controlled rendezvous. Aida had the presence of mind to give them about 30 seconds warning. Until then, it had all been going well. The Heptad had approached, using its thrusters to kill most of its velocity relative to the larger ship, and executed some little burns intended to bring it home to the docking port. Then Aida announced, in a barely controlled tone of voice, that one of the thruster modules had run out of propellant and could no longer perform its function.
"It's too heavy,"
Zeke muttered.
"They loaded in too much cargo. The thrusters are eating too much fuel trying to push all that crap around."
The Heptad came in too fast and at the wrong angle, and crashed into Caboose 2, which was a module, recycled from the wreckage of the shipyard 3 years ago, that they had plugged into the back of H1 to serve as the aftmost thing in the stack. They saw it happen on their screens, they felt it in their bones, and they heard the three spacewalkers exclaiming and cursing. A little storm of debris emerged from a hole that had evidently been torn in the skin of Caboose 2.
C2 depressurized, Tekla reported, sealed off from stack.
The debris cloud included one large object that had two arms, two legs, and a head. The limbs were flailing. Everyone watched silently.
We lost Michael Park,
one of the other spacewalkers announced.
We need more people back there,
Ivy announced to the crew in the Hammerhead. Ivy's message was clear. Later, we will mourn for Michael. Now, we have other things to worry about.
Moira, you stay, Ivy added.
Moira hadn't even moved. She was accustomed to being treated, against her own will and instincts, like a cherished and fragile child.
Maybe you could talk to Michael on the radio. He'll be alive for a while.
Moira nodded, swallowed hard, and focused on her laptop, entering the commands needed to establish a private voice link to Michael.
Dinah, you stay here. Run the robots. We are going to have to do some improvising. Bo, go back. Steve, too. Louisa, deal with Aida over voice. For me, it's too much stress and distraction. Stay in the Hammerhead and make that problem go away for me. Doob, stay here. Zeke, go back.
Ivy looked around.
If I haven't mentioned your name yet, go back and see what you can do. Doob, you're the weatherman. Your job is to make announcements about the storm and when it's going to hit.
Half an hour,
Doob said.
But yes, I will do that.
Moira, headphones on, had retreated into the quietest corner of the Hammerhead and was engaging in a murmured conversation with Michael. She was holding a cloth over her eyes to absorb tears before they broke loose in the cabin. Louisa had already gone into her assigned role and had been listening to a voice transmission from Aida. She says she's going to try it again.
I thought her thrusters were empty, Ivy said.
She can transfer propellant from some of the other thruster modules to the empty one. It'll take a few minutes. She requests instructions on where to make the next attempt, since the docking port on Caboose 2 has been rendered unusable. With a bit of deliberation, they agreed that the Heptad should make its next attempt on a docking port in the old Zvezda module. Dinah, who had spent most of the last couple of days preparing for the docking to occur on Caboose 2, sent her robots scrambling forward along the outside of the stack, bringing their cables with them. That caught her up in a stew of minor complications that more than filled the time it took for the Heptad to get its dead thruster up and running again. They watched the second approach and the docking in silence. It took about 10 minutes. Doob interrupted once to give an update on the approaching radiation storm. Unexpectedly, it was Moira who broke the silence.
"Don't let them dock," she said.
What?
Ivy said.
It's a trap.
Zeke's voice came over the PA.
Positive docking achieved. Getting ready to open the hatch.
Moira added, Michael figured it out.
15 minutes before the storm breaks,
Doob announced. Dinah had entered into a state of intense focus on the problem to be solved, seeing through the eyes of 10 different robots performing 10 different tasks, occasionally blurting out terse requests to the 2 surviving spacewalkers, asking them to shake a stuck cable loose or pull a wriggling grab out of trouble. She tried to filter out the conversation between Moira and Ivy.
What do you mean it's a trap?
Aida's Heptad joined the mesh network as soon as it got within range,
Moira said.
If you check your email right now, or your Spacebook, you'll see stuff flooding into it. Terabytes of old messages and posts that have been bottled up in the swarm. Mailing list traffic that's 3 years old.
So? Ivy asked. Michael saw some weird stuff just now and drew my attention to it. He's floating in space. He's floating in space and checking his email.
What weird stuff did he notice?
They're cannibals, Ivy.
We already know that.
A few hours ago, Moira said, they slaughtered Tav and ate what was left of him. Dinah was having difficulty focusing on her work. They wanted to be well fed for today. The time was approaching when the spacewalkers would have to go to their airlocks and get indoors ahead of the storm. Dinah had to focus on them. There was nothing she could do about what Moira was saying. She began speaking to one of them, but was interrupted when Zeke came over the PA again.
10 survivors aboard, waiting for JBF to emerge from the hatch.
Zeke, be on your toes, Ivy said. We have indications they may be up to no good. Get inside, Dinah said to the spacewalkers. Head for the nearest airlock. Stay away from the new people. We don't trust them.
Ditching the rock, Ivy announced.
A sharp hiss came through the walls as compressed air flooded the hair-thin gap between the outer surface of the hammerhead and the surrounding cavity of Amalthea.
Plug your ears.
Then, before anyone could comply, a shattering, sickening bang as Dinah's demolition charges went off, destroying the structural connections that joined Amalthea to Endurance. They felt a sharp jostle, more acceleration than they had experienced in 3 years, as the hammerhead sprang free, pushing the rest of Endurance along with it.
3 minutes before the storm hits,
Dube said. JBF is aboard, Louisa announced. She was on voice to Zeke and the rest of the crew aft, relaying what they said to the others in the hammerhead. Her brow wrinkled. Something's wrong with her. I don't quite follow.
Burning hard,
Ivy announced, meaning that they were near their apogee, entering the fringe of the main lunar debris cloud, and that all the surviving engines had just come on full force. She had inaugurated the big burn that would, with a delta-V of some 1,200 meters per second, inject them into the debris cloud. Every loose object in the hammerhead dropped to what was now the floor. At the same time, they could hear all manner of percussion from all over Endurance. Zeke's voice came in over the voice link.
"We are in combat," he said.
"Combat?" Ivy asked.
"They shot Steve Lake. We are now experiencing very high levels of high-energy proton radiation from the CME,
Dube announced.
Everyone who is not in the hammerhead should be getting into a storm shelter.
Shot him? Ivy asked.
With JBF's revolver. I suggest you try to lock down the network. They are trying to backdoor it.
After that, communications were hectic and confused for a minute, and seemed to suggest that adversaries in different parts of the ship were all trying to use the same channel. Then their communications went dead. The equipment still worked. They'd simply been locked out of the network. Ivy could still fly the ship, but none of them could talk to people outside the hammerhead. They were startled by a metallic rapping on the hatch that sealed the hammerhead off from the scrum. Dinah's ears soon read it as Morse code.
Chocolate, she said. That's kind of a code word between me and Tekla. I think we should open the hatch.
They did so, but not before arming themselves with whatever makeshift weapons they could find, and found Tekla, suffering from a knife wound to the hand, Zeke, looking flustered but unharmed, and a woman, barely recognizable as Julia Bliss Flaherty, given that most of her hair was gone, and she had both of her hands firmly clamped over her mouth. Tekla vaulted into the hammerhead and pulled Julia along behind her.
"What's going on?"
Ivy demanded. Zeke held up both hands.
"I got this,"
he said.
"We have killed 4 of them already. 2 more are casualties. We have them outnumbered. We just have to keep fighting."
"You need to get into a storm shelter,"
Ivy said. Tekla, unaccustomed to working in even weak gravity, had gotten her footing enough to drag Julia into a corner of the hammerhead and sit her down on the floor. She then turned back toward the hatch. Dinah had never seen Tekla in this state before, and feared her greatly in that moment. Moira had a different reaction. Peeling off her headphones, she lurched across the space and threw her arms around Tekla's neck. It looked like a greeting, but soon developed into something else as Tekla began dragging Moira toward the hatch, and Moira began trying to prevent her from returning to the fray.
"Sweet one," Tekla was mumbling into Moira's ear, "you want me to use wrestling moves on you. Then you should let me go, because I am going to kill that bitch Aida."
"Zipping into storm shelters is exactly what they wanted us to do,"
Zeke explained.
"Their plan was to take the ship as soon as we did so. Good thing you warned us."
Tekla, by now, had peeled herself loose from Moira's grip and advanced toward the hatch with a full stride. Zeke, waiting for her, reached out with one hand. He was holding a small black plastic box. He pressed it against Tekla's thigh and pulled a little trigger on its side. The device erupted with a sharp, ticking, buzzing noise. Tekla's leg collapsed, and she floated to the floor, glassy-eyed.
"Sorry, Tekla," Zeke said. "You stay here. Get your hand fixed. Keep Moira company. She needs you. And if you have a little boy, name it Zeke."
Then, before any of them could respond, he slammed the hatch shut. In the silence that followed, a sharp crack resounded through the structure of endurance. Everyone knew the sound. They'd just taken a hit from a bolide.
"Aren't you supposed to be flying the ship?"
Doob shouted to Ivy. Wordlessly, Ivy went back to her screen. Dinah rounded on Julia.
"What the hell is going on?"
she demanded. Julia's hair had been cropped. In the last 3 years, it had gone silvery. Her hands still obscured the lower half of her face. Her eyes were clearly recognizable, though without benefit of cosmetics, they seemed to be staring out of a face 2 decades older. Slowly, she removed her hands. She was sticking her tongue out. It looked like a piece of metal was caught in her teeth. On a closer look, it was clear that JBF now had a pierced tongue. It had been done cleanly and professionally. There was no bleeding, no apparent signs of infection or discomfort. A stainless steel bolt, about 2 inches long, had been inserted vertically through the piercing, fixed in place with nuts and washers above and below the tongue. It was too long to fit into Julia's mouth, so it kept her tongue stretched out. Above and below, the rod pressed against her lips.
"Oh, Jesus Christ!"
Dinah said. Julia tapped at the bolt with one finger, then made screwing and unscrewing gestures with both hands. The nuts had been doubled and torqued tightly against each other. Dinah took a multi-tool from a holster on her belt and unfolded its needle-nosed pliers, then borrowed Ivy's. By twisting gently in opposite directions, she was able to loosen the nuts. Julia pushed her away and unscrewed the nuts with her fingertips, then gently extracted the bolt. Her tongue retracted into her mouth. She put one hand over her lips and leaned back against a bulkhead for a few moments, moving her jaw to work up some saliva and get limbered up. When she finally spoke, Julia sounded weirdly normal, as if delivering remarks from the White House briefing room.
"When we surrendered," she said, "they took my gun, and they tortured Spencer Grindstaff until he spilled everything he knew about the IT systems here. All the passwords, all the backdoors, all the details as to how it all works. Exactly what they would need in order to take the place over. Then they killed him and..."
"Ate him?"
Julia nodded. "They have a sort of hacker type among their group. When he came on board just now, he went to a terminal and began to execute this plan. Steve Lake tried to stop him. One of the others had the gun, shot Steve to death. That was always part of their plan. They knew that only Steve could stop them."
"How many bullets are left in that thing?"
"I'm sure it is empty now. Most of them are using knives and clubs. They didn't expect a real fight because..."
Because they thought we'd all be zipped up in our storm shelters, Dinah said, like lambs to the slaughter. The big burn lasted for the better part of an hour. By the end of it, they'd consumed so much propellant and made endurance so light that acceleration made the blood fall out of their heads and pool in their feet. Ivy piloted the ship lying flat on her back, lest she lose consciousness. The journey was punctuated by a few terrific bangs, and those who could stand to watch Endurance's status readouts could observe various modules turning yellow, then red, then black, as they succumbed to damage. Dinah watched through the eyes of several cameras as a 10-mile-long piece of the moon tumbled past them, overtaking them, and zooming by just a few hundred meters to their starboard side. Nor was that the last such encounter. But with Doob acting as her wingman, calling out the biggest threats, and with Dinah making such use as she could of perambulator, Ivy was able to steer them clear of the big stuff. They had no way of knowing the progress of the combat aft. Zeke had spoken optimistically of their odds, but there was no telling how the damage they'd taken from bolides might have swung the course of the battle to one side or the other. Endurance's automatic sealing off of damaged parts of the ship had now partitioned her into a number of separate zones between which movement was impossible. Zero-G returned, meaning that the engines had shut off. They were now traveling as fast, on average, as the rest of the debris cloud. Dinah had only just adjusted to the steady acceleration of the big burn, and now felt a wave of sickness come over her as the inner ear readjusted. Her eyes closed, and she sank into a sort of catnap, floating loosely around the hammerhead, thudding gently against a wall every so often when Ivy used the thrusters to avoid a rock. Then she realized she'd been fully asleep for a time. Part of her wanted to stay that way, but she knew that big things were happening, so she opened her eyes, half expecting to find herself alone, the last person alive. Ivy was the only person awake, her face lit up by her screen. And for the first time in a long time, it looked the way it had used to when she'd been on the track of some fascinating science problem, alive, intent, fiercely joyful. "Why is it so quiet?" Dinah asked. For it seemed to her that it had been a long time since she had heard the crack of a bolide or sensed the thrust of one of Endurance's engines. "We're in the shadow," Ivy said, "a new cone of protection. Come here." She tossed her head. Dinah came around behind and hooked her chin over her friend's shoulder. The monitor had several windows open. Ivy enlarged one of them to fill most of the screen. A legend, superimposed at the bottom, identified it as aft camera. The field of view was entirely filled by a close-up image of a huge asteroid. Dinah was an asteroid miner. She had looked at many pictures of asteroids in her day. She had learned to recognize them by their shapes and their textures. She had no difficulty in identifying this one. "Cleft," she said. Ivy reached out and touched the screen. Red crosshairs appeared beneath her fingertip, which she dragged across the big rock's surface until it centered on a vast black crevasse that looked like it nearly split the asteroid in two, the canyon that had given this rock its name. She pulled her finger away, leaving the crosshairs in the middle of the cleft. "I was thinking here," she said. "How about a little below, where it gets wider?"
"I don't think we want a wide place. Too much exposure."
"Go there, then," Dinah suggested, reaching out and dragging the crosshairs to a slightly different location. "Then we can snuggle into the narrow part once we've gotten inside."
"You ladies enjoying yourselves?"
Doob rasped.
"Not as much as you're going to in about an hour," Ivy said.
"I'll try to hold out that long."
There was no problem getting into it. Ivy flew Endurance into the great crevasse like a Piper Cub into the Grand Canyon. Within minutes, the walls were reaching far above them. The bottom was still lost in shadow. Following Dinah's general suggestion, Ivy then nudged the ship toward a part of the canyon, several tens of kilometers distant, where the walls converged and the radioactive sky became a narrow, starry slit above. Still, she kept pushing onward, occasionally scraping the ship's outlying modules against the walls, until she reached a place where she could go no deeper. Looking both directions along the crevasse from this place, they could see spots where the sun was shining in. Here, though, they were protected from rocks and radiation alike. Ivy set Endurance down on the floor of the canyon. Clef's gravity was exceedingly faint, but it was enough to give words like that a little meaning, and it was enough to keep the ship lodged in one place until they decided to move it, which they never would. Cleft. On the surface of Cleft, a human weighed about as much as 3 pints of beer would weigh on Earth. Endurance weighed about as much as a couple of semi-trailer rigs. Ivy lit the ship's attitude control thrusters one last time and pivoted her tail up until it was vertical. Endurance was standing on her head, the Taurus aloft, iron hammerhead nose down on the iron floor of the crevasse. Dinah sent out some grabs to weld the ship to the asteroid. Ivy shut down the thrusters. Endurance was no longer a ship, but a building. From the hammerhead, now one piece of metal with Cleft, the stack ran straight up like the trunk of a tree. Various structures ramified outward from it like boughs. Its widest part was the array of 81 arclets that had formerly made up the stern of the ship. These now projected upward like leaves, or so they imagined. They couldn't actually go outside and look at it until they got out of the hammerhead. During the battle, they had sealed the hatch. By the time they had brought her to rest and welded her down, the rest of Endurance had been quiet for a long time. Finally, they opened the hatch and began to explore it one module at a time. They sent Buckies and Sci-Wise out ahead of them to illuminate dark spaces and aim cameras into hidden corners. Tekla then went in, taking point, with Dinah and Ivy watching her back. They were armed with cudgels made from lengths of pipe, but they never had to use them. It was some combination of crime scene, battleground, and disaster zone. Only about half of the modules were still pressurized. Some of them had become completely isolated and could only be reached by a person in a spacesuit. It took days to get to them all. In one of them they found Aida, the only other survivor from the Heptad. 2 days had passed since she had eaten the last of Tavistock prows, so she was very hungry, but otherwise in good shape. After becoming trapped by a combination of combat and bolide strikes, she had holed up in a water-filled storm shelter, then begun drinking its contents as she awaited rescue. The total number of living humans was now 16. Several had suffered injuries from combat or from the consequences of bolide strikes. Anyone who had not taken shelter in the hammerhead or in a storm shelter was suffering from radiation sickness. The healthy ones patched holes, repressurized modules, got the Taurus spinning again, and turned it into a sick bay, which filled up immediately. Dinah managed to get Dube out for one last spacewalk. He had been failing for days. Once they got him into the suit, though, his energy flooded back. Dinah took him out on the floor of the crevasse where he could walk, light-footed, with magnetized grabs latched onto his boots to keep him from floating away with every step. They rambled for about a kilometer, turning around every so often to look back at humanity's new home. Above the spinning Taurus, where Moira was even now unpacking her genetics lab, Tekla was inspecting the arclets on the top level, learning which were whole, which were beyond repair, and which could be patched up for future occupancy. On the floor of the crevasse, Grabs and Sywise were at work, rooting Endurance to her final resting place with spreading cables and struts. Where they walked, it was dark most of the time. That was the price of being sheltered from cosmic rays and coronal mass ejections. Looking up, however, they could see sunlight gilding the edges of the crevasse above them. They talked about how to set up mirrors that would bounce sunlight downward onto the arclets, which could grow food and scrub air in their translucent outer hulls. Dube spoke of endowment, the idea that, in time, a ceiling could be thrown over the top of the crevasse and walls built to keep in the air, whereupon a whole section of the valley could be given an atmosphere and turned into a place where children could go outside without the need for spacesuits. Then he walked home and died. They stored his body with the others in a damaged arklet that would serve as a mausoleum until such time as they could cut a grave out of Cleft's surface. That would take a long time, but the survivors all shared the conviction that, having sacrificed so much to make it here, they should be interred and not burned. Dube would share a grave with Zeke Peterson, Bowler Erdina, Steve Lake, and all the others who had died at about the same time. Some of those remained conscious long enough to relate the stories of what had happened to them during the conflict with the people who had come in from the swarm, and Endurance's final, hectic passage through storm and stone. Their counts were recorded and archived. One day, some historian would piece the story together, comparing it with data logs to figure out who had slain whom in combat and which module had gone dark when. Aida, of course, might have been their best source of information had she felt like talking, but she didn't. She had sunk into a profound depression, emerging from it at seemingly random moments to chatter about whatever stray thoughts were flitting through her head. No one wanted to talk to her. When she talked to you, she watched you too carefully with those avid, penetrating eyes, as if she saw, or imagined she saw, too deeply. It was impossible to be the object of that gaze without thinking of what she and the others had done, and without imagining that you were being sized up as food. An epic tale was told by the 3-year backlog of email, Facebook posts, blog entries, and other ephemera that filled up all of their inboxes as soon as the network of the swarm recombined with that of Endurance. The general arc of the story seemed to be a growing detachment from reality that had afflicted JBF and some of her inner circle. Louisa likened it to the growth of spiritualism after the First World War. During the 1920s, many who had not been able to bring themselves to accept the loss of life in the trenches and the subsequent influenza epidemic had fallen prey to the belief that they could communicate with their lost loved ones from beyond the grave. They had, in effect, sidestepped grief by convincing themselves that nothing had happened. The analogy was a loose one. The loss of life in the hard rain had, of course, been much worse, and few of the Arkies had adopted spiritualist beliefs per se. But after a particularly severe coronal mass ejection had slain nearly 100 Arkies, Tav had written a blog post about the journey he had made to Bhutan with Dube, and the conversation that they'd had en route with the king concerning the mathematics of reincarnation. It was a meditative piece, a secular eulogy for those who had fallen. But in retrospect, it seemed to mark an inflection point in the survivors' thinking. The swarm had always had a sort of quasi-divine status to some, who had, perhaps, read too much chaos theory too superficially and were prone to believing that its collective decisions, lying beyond human understanding, partook of the supernatural. The mishmash of techno-mystical ideation that had grown out of that one blog post was unreadable and incomprehensible to Louisa or to anyone else who read it after the fact with a clear mind, but it seemed to have offered hope and comfort to many terrified young people trapped in arklets. Tav, to his credit, had backed away from any efforts to elevate him to prophet-like status. If anything, though, his modesty might have backfired. "I have no idea," Louisa said, "how anyone could read these threats and find hope in them, or even meaning, but they did. Long enough to distract them from the real problems they were facing. And when Aida and the others finally came to their senses and began to push back against JBF and the others, the reaction was just that much more severe, because things had gone too far by that point. The backlash had started in a two-triad bolo where a number of like-minded Arkies, including Aida, had called bullshit on the prevailing tone and substance of official statements emanating from the White Arklet, and begun to denounce Tavistock Prowse as a puppet blogger for the regime. Dubbing themselves the Black Bolo Brigade, they had begun to spread their insurrectionist message to other Arklets in the swarm. That message, which made perfect sense as far as it went, was all about the need to face reality and to implement realistic, effective steps to address the swarm's problems. That included, if need be, throwing themselves on the mercy of endurance. They had demanded that JBF open the books and provide a current and accurate account of all stocks of water, food, and other staples, and how those numbers were changing over time. Julia had resisted those demands until the data had finally been leaked by a turncoat on her staff. The food picture had turned out to be bleak. This had led to a variety of responses that had determined the history and politics of the swarm ever since. Among some, a further retreat into mysticism and wishful thinking, based on a belief that the agent had been some sort of avenging angel sent by God, or by aliens so powerful that they might as well be God, to bring about the end of days and the merging of all human consciousness into a digital swarm in the sky. Among others, a frank embrace of cannibalism, in the sense not of killing people for food, but of eating those who had died of natural causes, as a stopgap measure until JBF could be toppled and replaced by people who knew what they were doing. The first group, the Mystics, had tended to rally under Julia's banner. The cannibals had ended up under Aida, who, because of her intensity and her charisma, had gradually emerged as the leader of the Black Bolo Brigade. The one swarm had thus fissioned into two smaller ones, neither of which was as viable, and thereby worsened the same problems that had led to the split in the first place. From there, the story had been predictable enough, and had led to the events of the last few days. Aida still wasn't talking, but Julia was. According to her, Aida and the other Black Bolo survivors had calculated, in the last weeks, that their turn to cannibalism would be so repugnant to the survivors of endurance as to render them permanent outcasts. Rather than passively await the judgment, which they foresaw as extremely pious, sanctimonious, and punitive, of Ivy and her clack, they would seize part or all of endurance, beginning with her network, and then negotiate terms from a position of strength. This explained, at least in a general way, everything that had happened, save possibly for the physical mutilation of both Julia and Tav. Asked for a theory as to that, Julia shrugged. "We were criminals to them. Criminals need to be punished. It's hard to punish people who are already starving to death in a confined space. What is really left in the executioner's toolkit other than attacking the body? They wanted to silence me, and so they did. And they wanted to give Tav a taste of his own medicine by uploading his physical body into theirs." A week later, when the last of the victims had succumbed to their wounds, or to radiation sickness, 8 humans remained alive and healthy. Ivy called for a 24-hour pause to grieve and to take stock. She then called a meeting of the entire human race. Dinah, Ivy, Moira, Tekla, Julia, Aida, Camilla, and Louisa. They did not know quite what to do with Julia and Aida. For years they had dreamed, in idle moments, of one day bringing JBF to justice, whatever that would mean. Then, at the last moment, she had been eclipsed by Aida. And now it all seemed a moot point anyway. Could six women put two women in jail? What would it mean to be in jail in a place like this? Corporal punishment was at least a theoretical possibility, but Aida had already gone there with results that they all found sickening. JBF was a threat to no one. Aida still possessed an air of menace, but short of locking her up in an arklet, there was nothing they could do about that save keep an eye on her. And so they did, never letting her out of their sight, never letting her get behind them. They met in the banana, sitting around the long conference table. To one side of it was death. The sick bay where Zeke, the last man alive, had given up the ghost a day and a half ago, after making a joke about what a shame it all was, being the only man alive with eight women to choose from. They had scrubbed the place down with bleach, and made the beds with clean sheets in hopes that none of them would be occupied for a long time. To the other side was life, the series of compartments where Moira had been setting up her genetics lab. The meeting would later be known as the Council of the Seven Eves, for though eight women were present, one of them, Louisa, had already gone through menopause. Ivy opened with a report on their general situation. From a certain point of view, this was surprisingly good. They had grown so inured to terrible news that she had to emphasize this more than once. Few places in the solar system were as safe as the one where they had come to rest. No cosmic radiation could touch them here. From coronal mass ejections, they were equally immune. Sunlight for energy and agriculture could be had a short distance above them, high on the walls of the crevasse, where the sun shone almost all the time. In the meantime, their big reactor, as well as 4 dozen arclet reactors, were producing far more power than they could ever use, and would continue doing so for decades. Of water, they still had 100 tons left over. While melting and splitting the water they'd used for propellant, they had extracted from it many tons of phosphorus, carbon, ammonia, and other chemicals left over from the dawn of the solar system that had once cloaked Greg's skeleton in a reeking black carapace. That stuff, as Sean Probst had well known, would be priceless as nutrients to support agriculture. They no longer had to worry, ever again, about the things that had been their obsessive concerns for the last 5 years. Perigees, apogees, burns, propellant, movement of any kind. No bolide could touch them down here. Even if Cleft banged into an equally large rock at some point, they would probably survive it. The vitamins that had been packed into every arclet launched up into the cloud arc had been intended to support a population of thousands. Even though many of these had been lost, what remained was still more than enough to keep a small colony in aspirin and toothbrushes for a long time. They were dependent, in many ways, on digital technology. They could not long survive without robots to do work for them and computerized control systems to keep the installation running. They had no ability to fabricate new computer chips to replace the old. But the architects, anticipating this, had stocked them with a large surplus of spare parts that would last for hundreds of years if husbanded carefully. And they had plans for rebooting digital civilization later. They had tools for making tools for making tools, and instructions on how to use them when the time came. With immediate needs accounted for, the discussion turned toward the obvious problem at hand. All heads turned toward Moira.
"My equipment made it through perfectly unscathed," she said. "The last 3 years have been boring for me. I have been treated as a fragile flower. I have spent the time writing up everything I know about how to use that stuff. If I drop dead of something tomorrow, you'll still be able to work it out. Obviously, we're all women. 7 of us are still capable of having babies,
or, to be specific, of producing eggs. So, where can we get some sperm? Well, 97% of what was sent up from Earth was destroyed in the disaster on the first day of the hard rain. What survived, survived because it had already been distributed among 10 different arklets. All 10 of those later ended up going off with the swarm. None of that material, however, seems to have made its way here. Aida interrupted. Staring across the table at Julia, she announced,
I was in the swarm, as you know. I can tell you that this fact of the samples in the 10 arklets was forgotten, never discussed. If anyone even knew they were there, they forgot about it soon.
Julia was construing this as an attack on her record. We had 800 healthy young men and women from every ethnic group in the world.
Had,
Aida repeated, we had. The amount of effort required to keep a few sample containers deep frozen wasn't worth the...
Stop, Ivy said. If we can start making babies, their great-grandchildren can pore over the records and make judgments and have debates about what should have been done. Now isn't the time for recriminations.
I was in the meeting where Marcus called bullshit on the Human Genetic Archive, Dinah said. She was mildly amazed to hear herself backing Julia's side of the argument.
We can't make the same mistake again,
Aida said, of fooling ourselves,
believing in shit that isn't real.
Ivy said,
had we known that it was going to come down so suddenly to 7 surviving fertile women, we would have had every healthy male masturbating into test tubes for the last 3 years. We'd have looked for ways to keep it all frozen, but we never imagined it would come to this.
It's not clear what the quality of the results would have been,
Moira put in. Given the amount of radiation exposure, I probably would have had to do a lot of manual repair on the genetic material in those samples.
Manual repair? Julia asked.
I should put that in scare quotes, Moira said, reaching up with both hands and crooking her fingers. Obviously, I'm not literally using my hands, but with the equipment in there, she tossed her head in the direction of the lab, I can isolate a cell, a sperm or an ovum, and read its genome. I'm skipping over a lot of details, obviously, but the point is that I can get a digital record of its DNA. Once that's in hand, it turns into a software exercise. The data can be evaluated and compared to huge databases that shipped up as part of the lab. It's possible to identify places on a given chromosome where a bit of DNA got damaged by a cosmic ray or radiation from the reactor. It is then possible to repair those breaks by splicing in a reasonable guess as to what was there originally.
It sounds like a lot of work, Camilla said. If there's anything I can do to ease your burdens and make myself useful, I am at your disposal.
Thank you. We will all be working at it for months, Moira said, before anything happens. We have very little else to do.
Excuse me, but what is the point of discussing this, since we have no sperm to work with?
Aida said.
We don't need sperm, Moira said. We don't need sperm to get pregnant. This is news to me,
Aida said with a sharp laugh. Moira went on coolly. There is a process known as parthenogenesis, literally, virgin birth, by which a uniparental embryo can be created out of a normal egg. It's been done with animals. The only reason no one ever did it with humans is because it seemed ethically dodgy, as well as completely unnecessary, given the willingness of men to impregnate women every chance they got.
Can you do it here, Moira? Asked Louisa.
It's not fundamentally more difficult than the sorts of tricks I was just describing in the case of repairing damaged sperm. In some ways, it would actually be easier.
You can get us pregnant.
By ourselves, Tekla said. Yes, everyone except Louisa. I can have a child, of whom I am both the mother and the father, Aida said.
The idea clearly fascinated her. Suddenly, she was no longer the prickly, brittle Aida, but the warm and engaged girl who must have charmed the powers that be during the casting of lots.
"It will take some tricky work in the lab," Moira said, "but that is the whole point of having brought the lab safely to this place."
They all pondered it for a bit. Julia was the first to speak up.
"Stepping into my traditional role as scientific ignoramus, do you mean to say that you can clone us?"
Moira nodded, not to say yes, but to say, "I understand your question."
"There are different ways to do it, Julia. One way would indeed produce clones, all offspring genetically identical to the mother. This isn't what we want. For one thing, it would not solve our basic problem, the lack of males."
Camilla's hand went up.
Moira, clearly annoyed by the interruption, blinked once, then nodded at her.
"Is it really a problem?"
Camilla asked.
"As long as we have the lab and can go on making more clones, would it really be such a bad thing to have a society with no males, at least for several generations?"
Moira silenced her with a gentle pushing movement of one hand.
"That's a question for later. There is another problem with this version of parthenogenesis, which is, again, that all offspring are the same, exact copies. To get some genetic diversity, we need to use something called automictic parthenogenesis. Look, it's a long story, but the point is that in normal sexual reproduction, there is crossing over of chromosomes during meiosis. It's a form of natural recombination of DNA. It's what causes your children to look sort of like you, but not exactly like you. In the form of parthenogenesis that I am proposing to use, there would be that crossing over, an element of randomness."
"And both boys and girls?" Dinah asked.
"That's harder," Moira admitted. "Synthesizing a Y chromosome is no joke. My prediction is that the first set of babies, perhaps the first few sets of them, will all be female, because we simply need to get the population up. During that time, I can be working on the Y chromosome problem. Later on, I hope that some little boys will result."
"But these little girls, and later the boys, will still be made out of our own DNA?"
Ivy asked.
"Yes.
So they'll be quite similar to us genetically."
"If I do nothing about it," Moira said, "they'll be like sisters. Perhaps even more similar than that implies. But there are a few tricks that I can use to create a wider range of genotypes out of the same source material. Perhaps they'll be more like cousins. I don't know. It's never been tried."
"Are we talking about the inbreeding problem?" "It sounds like it," Dinah said.
"Loss of heterozygosity. Yes, I happen to know something about it. It's why I was chosen as a member of the general population."
"Because of your work on black-footed ferrets and so on,"
Ivy said. "Yes, this is a closely analogous problem. But the point I would like you all to keep in mind is that we solved that problem in the case of the black-footed ferrets, and we are going to solve it again."
She said it with force and confidence that silenced the others for a few moments and left them looking at her for more. Moira went on. "I think we all have at least an intuitive understanding of this, yes?" That one was aimed at Julia, who looked mildly peeved and bit off the following.
"My daughter had Down syndrome. That is all I will say."
Moira acknowledged it with a nod, then went on.
"Everyone has some genetic defects. When you are breeding more or less randomly within a large population, there's a tendency for those errors to be swamped by the law of averages. Everything sort of works out. But when two people sharing the same defect mate, their offspring is likely to have that defect as well, and over time we see the usual unpleasantness that we all associate in our minds with inbreeding."
"So," Louisa said, "if we follow the plan you have laid out, and begin, a few years down the road, with seven groups of what amount to siblings or cousins, it's not enough heterozygosity to answer your question.
Moira said. If you have a genetic predisposition to any disease, for example...
Alpha thalassemia runs in my family,
Ivy said. That's a fine example, Moira returned. As it happens, Old Earth compiled vast databases on such things before its destruction, all of which are in there now. She gestured in the direction of her lab. We have a very good idea which defects on which chromosomes are responsible for alpha thalassemia. If you supply me with an ovum, I can find those defects and I can fix them before we begin parthenogenesis. Your offspring will be free of that defect. Barring some random future mutation, it'll never return. Dinah raised her hand. My brother was a carrier of cystic fibrosis. I haven't been tested. Julia raised hers.
Three of my aunts died of the same form of breast cancer. I've been tested. I know I carry that defect as well.
The same answer applies in all of these cases, Moira said. If there's a genetic test for it, then it means, by definition, that we know which defects are responsible for it. And knowing that, we can perform a repair. A new voice joined the conversation. How about bipolar disorder? Everyone looked at Aida. She would live out the rest of her life and go to meet her maker without having a friend or even a friendly conversation. So no one was in a receptive frame of mind about her question. But the mere fact that she'd asked it suggested a level of introspection they hadn't seen from her before. Moira considered it. I would have to do some research. I think that it does run in families to some extent. To the extent that it can be traced to particular locations on particular chromosomes, it can be treated like any other disease, Moira said. Do you believe it should be? Aida asked. Everyone looked automatically at Louisa, who nodded. We are long past the point of thinking of mental illnesses as somehow a lesser kind of disease than physical. Such disorders should, in my opinion, be addressed in just the same way. Do you believe it must be? Louisa colored slightly. What is the point of these questions, Aida?
I have done research on it, Aida said. Some say that bipolarity is a useful adaptation. When things are bad, you become depressed, retreat, conserve energy. When things are good, you spring into action with great energy.
And your point is,
will you treat this condition in my offspring against my will? What if I want to have a lot of little bipolar kids?
In the flustered silence that followed,
Camilla spoke.
What about aggression? Everyone turned to look at her, as if unsure they had heard her correctly.
I'm serious, she said. She looked toward Aida. I don't mean to trivialize the suffering that your condition causes, but over the course of history, aggression has caused a far larger amount of pain and death than bipolar disorder or whatever. As long as we're fixing those aspects of the human psyche that lead to suffering, should we not eliminate the tendency to aggressive behavior?
That's different,
Moira began, but she was interrupted by Dinah. Hold on a sec, Dinah said. I'm aggressive. I always have been. I was on track to be an Olympic soccer player. That's the only way I've ever been able to amount to anything, by channeling my aggression into doing things. She nodded across the table at Tekla. Hell, look at her. How many times has she saved our asses by being aggressive? Tekla nodded.
Yes. Dinah saved me by taking aggressive action against rules of space station. Problem is not aggression. It is lack of discipline. A person can be aggressive, she nodded at Dinah, and still be constructive in society if she controls her passions.
And she threw a significant look at Aida, who let out a little snort and looked away.
So you're suggesting we breed people for discipline and self-control? Ivy asked. I'm not sure if I follow. I believe that Kamala was merely saying that certain personality types, taken to an unhealthy extreme, are as bad as diagnosable mental illnesses per se, if not worse, Julia said.
I don't want you to speak for me,
Kamala said.
Please do not speak for me any more, Julia.
I am merely trying to be helpful, Julia said. But where the old JBF would have said it reproachfully, the new one merely seemed exhausted.
Dinah broke in. Well, what I am trying to say is that I don't appreciate being labeled as a genetic freak that needs to be eradicated from the human future.
No one would say that of you, Dinah,
Ivy said. Kamala's talking about the knuckle-draggers who tried to kill her for wanting an education.
And what is your opinion?
Tekla asked Ivy.
Similar to yours. Aggression is fine. It needs to be controlled, directed, but the way to do that is through intelligence, rational thought.
That elicited a cackle from Aida.
Oh, sorry, she said. I was thinking about the swarm. 800 people, all carefully hand-selected for intelligence and rational thought. In